Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
Rita Zoe Chin is the author of Let the Tornado Come, and it is a memoir clearly about her life. Rita Zoe Chin is one of the 40 million Americans who suffer from an anxiety disorder. And to those who don't know, an anxiety disorder can seem like much ado about nothing. But to those who live in anxiety, life can be a daily, moment by moment, minute by minute sometimes, second by second sometimes, struggle. Allow me to introduce you to today's guest, Rita Zoe Chin. Hello, Rita. How are you?
Hi, Pamela. I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
I am doing well. And you probably know already that you have written really a beautiful book. It's interesting the way you have strung your words together.
Well, thank you.
Let's start with just sort of describing to folks who may not know what it means to suffer from an anxiety disorder.
There are many kinds of anxiety disorders, as you well know, and
right.
The one that I was struggling with was panic. So I was having panic attacks. Some people have social anxiety or other kinds of anxiety, but
sure.
I was having full-blown panic attacks, and so for me, what that meant was that I was having fight-flight reactions. You know, where that thing that happens where you hear some sound in the middle of the night and your heart starts pounding, and I was having that with no provocation or no obvious provocation. So it just at any moment my body would launch itself into a fight flight response, and that is a terrifying experience when there isn't a provocation, there isn't a reason. You know,
Of course, you just have no way of feeling safe.
Exactly, because it's in you.
Right.
You
right.
can't escape it. You know, you can run away from the burglar, but you can't run away from yourself.
Right.
Obviously.
And many people though who struggle with anxiety disorder try to do just that. Really try to run away from themselves. Themselves being their experience of the enemy. So it's really very hard. But your life did not begin with this kind of experience. Talk to us about your early beginnings, where you were born, what family you were born into. Tell us about that.
I was born in Queens, and we lived very near an airport. And because of that, it was interesting because the first few years of my life, the apartment shook and, you know, the planes roared overhead. And so that alone is kind of a scary thing for a little girl, for a baby. And I remember my father used to put his hands over my ears to try to muffle the sound. But unfortunately, that gesture changed because my parents were... They were very young, and they were a mess. They were addicted to drugs. They were violent, and so they started fighting a lot, and very quickly my home became a very violent place. So we moved when I was four to Maryland, and that was where we were supposed to have peace and quiet, and things were going to be better. But pretty soon thereafter, the police were coming to our house on a regular basis.
Okay. So as an infant born in Queens, New York, but living near a airport, what was the name of the airport you lived near?
Kennedy Airport.
Kennedy Airport. So
yeah.
Really a busy airport. And you know, we're learning more and more about the impact of the environment on infants. So clearly that was traumatizing, just trying to go to sleep at night, but even just being in an apartment that would sort of shake, and you didn't know if you were safe or not.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of no wonder, although, you know, my struggle with panic happened so many years later, and it happened, interestingly enough, at a point in my life where everything was as peaceful as it had ever been. And I was living in a little bucolic town where the planes never roared overhead, and there were cows across the street. And so it was interesting, the time lapse between that initial kind of introduction to the world and the onset of panic.
It is interesting, but what's also interesting is really the experience, because as a baby, you were living in a place where, as an infant, you did not know when the house was going to shake. You did not know when this thing was going to happen. It would just sort of happen. And that's the same experience that you had with the panic attacks. Once they started, you didn't know when they were going to happen. They just happened.
Exactly. And the same with my parents, too. You never knew
when it
was going to be a bad one.
Were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
I have a younger sister.
All right. So you were in Queens, New York for a bit. You moved to Maryland. It was supposed to be a grand, peaceful, lovely move. And what happened when you moved to Maryland?
As we were talking about panic, you can't escape yourself. And my parents, despite moving to a much quieter, more peaceful place, they were not peaceful. And so they're fighting just accelerated and amplified in every way, and then it wasn't only between them, but I became their target as well. It's interesting. I've read that this happens more often than people I think would think, but mm-hmm. My parents never hit my sister, my little sister, but so I was their main target.
But and not hitting her doesn't mean that she wasn't also affected, of course, and abused, certainly, by the experiences that you had. That you talk about in your book a moment when you were having breakfast and you were supposed to be eating eggs, and that just turned into a huge drama. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. My mother, bless her, was not a great cook, and she cooked soft-boiled eggs, and they were not really soft-boiled. They were barely boiled, so they were slimy, and as a young girl, that was really hard for me to get down, literally, and so it often ended up in a standoff, where I'd have to sit at the table and try to eat it anyway and gag and all these things. And so one day, because kids want to make their parents proud, of course. And, as a child, I kept trying to figure out some way to make my parents see that I was actually good and, that they, I would do the magic thing that, would make them really proud and make them love me. And so I thought, today I'm going to eat that egg, that slimy, disgusting egg. I'm going to eat the whole thing. And so I did. And I was so happy to have finally gotten down that last bite that I, ran into the living room to tell my father. And, he was, instead of being proud of me, he was disgusted because I had, I hadn't finished chewing, and it was very, impolite
right.
of me mm-hmm. to come and announce to him with egg dripping down my face that I had eaten it. So that resulted in a beating from him. So,
well, when you think about it, I mean, here you had done something as a little one quite amazing on a whole bunch of levels. and rather, as you said, rather than, I mean, just the idea of being forced to eat something is a whole other conversation, but rather than acknowledging the hard work that you had put into accomplishing the consumption of this egg, you in fact were punished.
Yes. Yeah.
And you were punished often for things that didn't make sense to you. Is that correct?
Yeah. It would be something that I did wrong, but like a small thing that every kid does, but it would land me in a real serious kind of trouble.
And while this was going on for you, your sister, what was she saying or doing? Was she acknowledging her awareness?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the worst moment. I don't want to be depressing, but one of the I'm okay now. But one of the worst moments of abuse from my father was involved a belt, and my sister was, I guess, around 4 at the time, and my father. Okay, so I just have to backtrack. There was a reason for this. It's because I had told my mother to shut up, and the reason I did is because she would do this thing where she would put these headphones on and then ignore us.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how frustrating that was as a young girl to be ignored, you know, because, you know, I would start talking to her and, you know, please don't ignore me. Please listen to me, please. And she would walk around like singing, not just pretending like I wasn't there. And so I said the really bad word to get her attention. I said, well, you shut up. So I was getting beaten for that. He was you know, incredibly creative, I guess I would say, with the way he did it. So he had me hanging upside down, and he was holding my ankles, and he was just, you know, going after me with this belt. And my little sister was watching, and she tried to intervene. She actually tried to jump in, and the buckle caught her in the lip. She started to bleed, and my father immediately dropped me to the ground and the belt and ran to her to tend to her. So she was feisty, and she wanted to protect me, but I mean, how could she? In that moment, she actually did.
And you know, that was, you're saying that was creative. That was insanely abusive.
Yes, that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And in your sister being exposed to that, while she may not have experienced, in that case, she was hit in the lip, but while she may not have experienced physically what was going on when you were being assaulted by your family, certainly emotionally, she would have experienced many layers, many levels of pain and shame herself.
Oh yeah, definitely. She struggles with survivor's guilt.
Yeah,
and you know, I think the hardest thing for her was watching me run away later.
Can you talk about when you first began to run away? How old were you?
I was 11, actually, the very first time.
Okay.
And then I started running away more regularly when I was 12. And really 13 was the time when I ended up fully gone from my parents.
Okay.
On the streets.
All right. I tell you what, we are going to take a break now. But when we come back, I would like to start with your first, the first time you ran away, and get a sense of what was going on in your life that prompted you to run. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Rita Zoe Chin, author of Let the Tornado Come. We will be back in just a moment. are back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with Rita Chin, author of Let the Tornado Come. Rita, just before the break, you shared with us your age, the first time you ran away from home, and you were 11. What was going on that prompted that first run?
So my father would regularly go through my belongings, and that day he had taken I carried this big red purse, and it had, you know, letters in it, and it also had a Judy Blume book called Wifey. I don't know if you remember that book, but it was kind of racy.
Okay.
And I had kind of swiped it from my mother's bookshelves and wasn't supposed to have it, and, you know, among other things, and he had taken it from me. I came in from being outside, and he and my stepmother had it strewn, you know, all emptied and strewn all over their bed. And he called me in, and I was standing in the doorway, and
yeah,
he was berating me for the things I had in it. And they were my things, and but they weren't. So, you know, nothing was sacred, nothing was mine. And in that moment, it was a really interesting moment, because it's almost as if they sort of telescoped away from me, and I stood there looking at them, and I knew that I would probably get beaten for whatever it was that I had in there that I shouldn't have had. And so I visualized the door, the front door. I kept seeing it in my mind, even though I was looking at these people on their bed with my things. And, you know, in a flash, I turned and ran and flung that front door open and kept running and didn't stop for a couple of miles.
For a couple of miles, where did you land?
Waldbaum's.
Okay.
I ended up in a grocery store. Yeah, it was suburban. We were back. We had moved to Maryland, and then we had moved after my parents divorced and he remarried. We moved to East Northport, New York, and so that's where we were at that time.
Okay.
And, so we were in suburbia, and that's where I ended up.
You ended up in Waldbaum's. And tell us about that whole period, that first time. You've run away, so for a moment, at least you have the experience of freedom and safety from them. I would think that would have been short-lived.
It was, but that moment, in a way, saved my life. Because, you know, here my father had been bullying me regularly for years, and that, you know, every day I felt afraid, I felt powerless. I never knew, you know, every time he walked into the door, you know, walked in the front door, my stomach would just sink, and I never knew what was going to happen. And here was this moment where I was taking charge of my own life, and I actually had this power, and that was to get away. And so that was incredibly, you know, it was useful for me to know that was in me.
That you had the ability to make choices even at 11.
Yes.
I can't imagine.
And it also helped me to not internally, because it was a moment where I crossed the threshold, where I separated my parents, my family from myself.
Okay.
And I, instead of saying, oh, well, it must be me, it must be the way I eat eggs,
saying,
no, it's you and I need to get away. And so that was really crucial in my, I think, in my development and my thinking about myself growing up.
So it sounds actually huge. I can't imagine you stayed at Waldbaum's for too long.
No. I was there for about 3 hours before, I guess, somebody kind of was like, why is this child, you know, loitering around the payphone?
Mm-hmm.
And the police did come. And, you know, it was the 80s. And back then, you know, it wasn't like it is now, where you lay a hand on your kid and you've got social services banging on your door. I mean, back then, you know, people turned their heads the other way. And
right.
So I, you know, begged the police not to take me back. And, but, you know, my father, you know, was doing fairly well financially at that time. And, you know, we lived in a decent neighborhood, and they weren't going to listen to me. And they didn't. And they brought me back.
And what was your reception like from your family when you returned?
Interestingly enough, I only saw my father when I got back. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm in huge, huge, huge trouble. But, you know, he didn't say a word, and he just told me to go to bed, and I went into my room, and my red purse was sitting there on the bed. And so it was a standoff, and maybe one of the only standoffs, you know, that I won, but I did win.
How did your sister respond to her sister running away?
I don't remember her response at that time, but, you know, one of the hardest times, in fact, she can't even talk about it without, to this day, breaking down, is, you know, I later, we moved back to Maryland, and we were living in Rockville, and I had run away. But I, you know, missed my sister and worried about her, and so I would come back and into the neighborhood. And one day, I had thrown a rock at her window, and she came and saw me, and I was standing down in the outside the it was a townhouse, and then there was a little like alleyway behind it, and I was standing in that alleyway looking up at her, and we were just looking at each other and smiling and waving, and my father then suddenly appeared behind her, and I just turned and took off and bolted away, and you know that I think was incredibly traumatic for her to have been sharing this moment with me when she missed me so much, and then to watch me turn and run away. That was hard for her.
It sounds like there was a lot of trauma for both of you, quite frankly.
Sadly, yeah, there was.
When you were running away, would there be a same place that you would go, or would you go to different places?
One place, you know, in Rockville, when I started running away there, it was, you know, a lot more populated than suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was that mean Rockville Pike that I would end up on, and I would get picked up by men. You know, that's the sad reality is a 13-year-old with eyeliner on is very attractive to to men.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is sad. And how old were you when you stopped running away?
I was 15, almost 16. Well, I guess 15 and a half. And then I was also institutionalized. So by the time I was 13, I never went home again, and I was either lived on the streets or in institutions for the next couple of years. And I was 15, almost 16 years old when I finally got released from the court system. So,
you know, one of the myths that people often believe is that if they see a homeless child on the street, that she comes from a poor neighborhood, a poor single parent family, just poverty in every single way that you can imagine. And that's just not true. Many runaways have run away to save their lives, and it's not related to where they lived, the economic standing of the family, the educational standing of the family. Those things fade into the background.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not surprising. I think that the statistic last time I read about it was there were at least like 1.5 million homeless children in the States here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So some of them have to come from, you know, families of means, I would imagine. But that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Years ago, I worked with a group home, and it was all girls, but they were all girls who came from families of means. They didn't run away because there was no financial means. They ran away because it was not physically, sexually, emotionally safe.
Yes. Yeah.
You stopped running away at 13 by...
At 15.
But at 15. Yeah. And so here you are, a young teenager, sort of an old young teenager. I mean, your life experiences were such that you were old beyond your teenage years. What did you do when you were released from the system? You weren't having panic attacks at this point. Where did you go? What did you do?
excuse me. My mother actually... because I was still a minor, the system had to send me home, and my mother ended up getting custody again. So she had lost custody to my father, but then anyway, that's a different part of the story. But in any case, there was nothing she could do. The system had released me, and she didn't want me, but you know, she couldn't refuse me. So I went back and lived with her, but only for really a matter of a couple of months. And it was untenable. And so I ended up leaving.
What made it untenable?
Well, my mother, it was one of those sad relationships you know, where my mother was so hated herself so much that, of course, she had to hate me.
Mm.
And, you know, it's funny because, you know, a kid runs away from a violent home and she's the one who gets institutionalized and
right.
has to talk to psychiatrists and how, you know, all these things and has to have treatment plans. And then she goes and she gets sent back to the same home that she ran from.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So it's of course it's designed to fail, and it did. And my mother was still my mother, and she was still, you know, vicious and, you know, yeah, so it was never going to work. And so I left.
As you were a youngster and then a young teen and then an older teen, did you imagine a future for yourself?
I did. I mean, that's what fueled me as a runaway all those years. excuse me, it was a grainy future.
Mm.
I'm so sorry. Forgive me. It's winter and it's very cold here in Boston and the heat just dries your throat out.
I get that.
yeah, I wanted love. I wanted a happy life. I imagined what it looked like because, you know, I mean, I could see my friends who had it had had it. And so it was, I imagined that for myself, and that's what I was looking for.
You know, what's interesting is that having grown up in a household that was so traumatizing, literally from day one, having planes overhead, to the physical and emotional abuse that you experienced at the hands of your parents, and the running away. I mean, it would have been easy for you to sort of fall off the tracks and stay off the tracks. But there was something about you that didn't allow that to happen.
Well, I almost did, Pamela. I ended up addicted to drugs when I was 18. Had a very serious cocaine addiction,
mm-hmm.
And I was an intravenous drug abuser at that time, and I nearly died. And in fact, I went to my childhood pediatrician because I was so sick, and he said, "You're gonna die."
Mm.
And for the, you know, you think you're invincible, especially at that age.
Sure.
And but the first moment I understood, oh, like, as in my life will be over. Okay, I get that. And suddenly I was terrified because I realized that this thing I had been running for all these years, you know, life, I was taking it away with my own hand. And I didn't want it. That's not what I wanted. I did want to live. I did want love, and I wanted a life. And, so I quit and, never touched it again. And that was the beginning of my creating that life that I had been hoping for. You know, that was the beginning of my creating it for myself. So
we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like to start with your introduction to the world of horses. There is a stunning horse on the cover of your book. And I think that that is really I know that that's an important part of your experience and an important part of your life. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will revisit Rita and meet her horse. Don't go away, folks.
Thank you.
And we are back. This is Pamela Brewer. Rita, again, there's a amazing visual of a horse on the cover of your book. So when you think about Kennedy Airport, Queens, New York, Rockville, Maryland, not sure that horses comes to mind. So tell us how you were introduced to horses and why it's such an important part of your life.
When we lived in East Northport, a girl in my neighborhood I was friends with had a horse, and she invited me to the barn one day. And from the moment, we got there, I sometimes recognize things even though you've never seen it before? It's
exactly.
Like you know it.
Yeah.
And that's what it was another world, and yet it was a world I felt immediately just completely enamored of. The smell and the beauty, the grace, the power of horses, and this relationship. So she came up and her horse nickered for her, and he was a beautiful horse, and such a large creature, and to have that kind of graceful, gentle interaction with such a powerful beast is amazing. And so I fell in love, of course, but of course, for me, it was not to be mine, and I knew it. And so I carried this longing for horses, but for years, that's all it could ever be. And then I grew up, and I kind of thought, Christopher Reeves, it's scary, people die, and I kind of let fear, keep me from doing it.
Mm.
Or trying it, I'd been like on vacation where you could go horseback riding, and I thought, ooh, horseback riding. And I thought, no, dangerous, scary.
Okay.
And didn't do it. And then of course, in the middle of, the throes of panic, that's when I decided to launch myself onto a giant flight creature.
And it was very useful for you.
It was, it ended up being, the thing that got me the rest of the way. At that point, when I, went and got on a horse for the first time, I had been finding my way through panic and was definitely seeing the light at that point.
Okay.
But my relationship, pardon?
No, please continue.
Just my relationship with horses after that really pulled me through the rest of the way.
Let's go back a little bit before we go forward. We're pretty clear as to what life was like until your late teens. At some point, you met and you married. Talk about that.
Yeah, so, I was telling you I basically came back from the brink of death and built my life. And I never went to high school because you don't do that when you're a runaway, but I did go and get my GED and I thought I want to go to college because I had always been a writer and I'd always loved reading. And so I went to college and then I went to grad school and I fell in love with writing and literature again.
Mm-hmm.
But now I was in a place where people were, professors were saying, this thing, you're pretty good at it. You should keep doing it. And so I became a technical writer to help put myself through college. And then I ended up teaching at the college where that I attended, Towson University. And then at a picnic, a big party that my boss threw, there was Larry. We met, and he was a neurosurgeon at the time at University of Maryland. And we instantly liked each other, and so we got married.
Well, and then everything was wonderful, right?
Everything was, it was, I kind of felt like, oh, here's the life that I imagined when I was looking at the L.L. Bean catalog. it was a happy life. He was, he's a great guy and very sweet, and they absolute opposite of my parents in every way. It was a good life. But then we moved from Maryland. He took a job as chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at here in Boston at Boston Medical Center. And we moved to this really peaceful little town. And then, a couple months later, I was calling 911 thinking I was having a heart attack.
So talk about that first panic attack.
It was the most ridiculously uneventful thing. I was just sitting at my computer. I wasn't even working at that moment. I was just mindlessly, doing that thing that we probably all, many people, I know I spend too much time. I'm trying to be better about that. But, I was on the internet, and all of a sudden I had this strange feeling and my heart started galloping away, and it was terrifying. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack. And I grabbed the phone and I ran outside for some reason and called 911.
And was it a heart attack?
It was not. It was a panic attack. But I was in disbelief because it was such a physical thing that was happening. And, for the EMT kind of suggested that that's what it might be, because my heart rate was incredibly high. But it was a normal rhythm. So, they offered to take me in, but to the hospital, but they were kind of like, we think you're okay. And it seems like, we had this other lady who calls all the time with panic attacks. And I'm like, panic attacks? It's not a panic attack. Something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with my heart. But they left, and I looked up panic, and all the symptoms matched.
And what was your husband's reaction to this?
It's funny. Being a physician, a Western trained doctor, they have answers for things. Here's what you do.
Right.
And I wasn't fixable that way. And so I think I proved quite frustrating to Larry because because panic is so illogical and yet it's so real. So, I started becoming afraid of things that most people would never dream of being afraid of, and including exercise. And so, he would say, you're fine, or going up a flight of stairs or going through the checkout line or taking a shower by myself. And he would say, but you're fine. You're fine. You're going to be fine. and I was like, okay, I appreciate that. But I
don't
feel fine.
Yeah.
I feel
like
I need to call 911 pretty much every minute of the day.
So you're laughing now, which, hindsight is always brilliant, but you're describing really amazingly just sort of mundane things. Walking up a flight of stairs, taking a shower by yourself, standing in the checkout line. I mean, people do that all day long, every day. And for those to be areas that were so hard for you, I mean, it just sounds like such an exhausting, burdensome, terrifying way to live your life.
It was. And in fact, I ended up being just completely incapacitated. And I remember lying on the couch thinking, okay, I just won't move. And then nothing bad can happen to me. But then I remembered, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a show called That's Incredible in the 80s.
Okay.
And on the show, they had somebody, they talked about this woman who had spontaneously combusted. And by the time they found her, all that was left were her shoes and this like pink smoke. And as a imaginative child, I was like, oh, wow, that can happen. That's kind of amazing. And so I always imagined like what that would be like. And so as I'm lying there on the couch now in my 30s, thinking I'm just never going to move. Of course, but I thought, well, I'll just probably end up spontaneously combusting then. And so it's like there really truly was no safe place. And yes, I mean, I laugh about it now because it is, I have a distance from it, and it's kind of, you have to have a sense of humor because it is absurd, but it doesn't feel absurd in the least when it's happening.
Not at all. And, for those folks who are listening to us talk about this now, who haven't gotten to the other side of what you experience, what can you say to them? Are there first steps that you would ask that they consider taking, or ways to think about their experiences?
Well, the first thing I would just say is, you're not alone. When it's happening, it feels terrifying and it feels like you're alone. And I had read that 40 million Americans have some kind of anxiety disorder, but I didn't know any of them.
Right.
I was wondering, where are they? Because it seems like pretty much it's just me. And it's because people don't talk about it. And but there are so many people who are afraid. And once I started talking to other people about it, it was amazing to me how many people have said, "Oh my gosh, I have panic attacks too," or, you know, "I have this kind of anxiety." Or and you know, the other thing that I would say is that, you know, we're stronger than we know. And it's, I know that to be true, and I promise that's true.
You know, that's really an important reminder, because in fact we are so much stronger than we know, and we often lose sight of that. For you, as you were trying to sort of figure out what was going on with you and how to be free of these panic attacks, what steps did you take?
Oh my gosh. I took a lot of steps. One of the bigger steps is I went and had cognitive behavioral therapy at the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, because I thought if it's called that, they have to be able to fix me. And so I think I'm worse. And he said, "Well, you know, that of course that didn't work for you. That's, you know, it works for a lot of people, but it's got no heart. And that's what you need." And he identified that part of my panic had a PTSD component.
Interesting.
Yeah. So of course, I mean, think about like all that trauma as a child, and I had finally gotten to a safe place where it was okay. Because I think in my life, I had always just been, I'd been engaged in a fight flight response, and that
yes.
was to run.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I didn't have to run. And so like, it was almost like I turned that fight flight inward, and it was a really interesting thing. So it was very helpful just to have somebody say, "I understand." And,
yes.
You know, yeah. And not try to make me run in place with a stopwatch.
And give you some ways to think about it, to understand it differently from what you did at that moment.
Yeah, he talked about panic and anxiety. A lot of times that we end up reverting to a child, he calls it a child place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the world feels really big and we feel really small and really afraid. And through something called EMDR, where I was able to kind of visualize myself as my adult self kind of going back and rescuing the younger me who
mm-hmm.
Who needed to be rescued. And so that was empowering, and it definitely but I also, you know, at that time I started pushing myself a little, so I, you know, as somebody who was afraid to get up off the couch, like getting in my car and just driving to, you know, for a couple of miles was a big deal, but I made myself do it. And, you know, as they say, baby steps. That's what I did.
But you know, for sometimes those baby steps are the largest and most important steps to be made. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Rita Zoe Chin, author of Let the Tornado Come. We will take a break and be right back.
Thank you.
And we're back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with Rita Zoe Chin. Rita, one of the points that you're clearly making that I think is so important is that one-size therapy does not fit all. One-size way to think about or to try to work on creating the life for yourself that you want does not fit all. Sounds like you tried as many traditional and non-traditional routes as you possibly could.
I did. And, you know, sometimes it's well, there's one thing I didn't do, and that was I didn't take medication. And a lot of people said you should really take something. And I thought, well, I've gone, you know, this many years without it. And, I was convinced that there was something for me to learn. And I think as a society, we're trained to never be uncomfortable. You know,
it's true.
Have a little headache, take an Advil. You have this, you take that. You know,
right.
You're feeling a little down, take this pill. And to just say, okay, you know, I've never experienced this before, but I'm experiencing it now. And being a curious person, my question was why. And So I wanted to understand it. And, you know, sometimes it's the simplest things. You know, I was telling you about, you know, talking to that last therapist that I chanced. And one of the biggest things that helped, believe it or not, was such a simple and obvious thing, and yet it wasn't obvious at the time, and that was to have compassion for myself.
Yes.
And yeah, I think people when they feel afraid, the thing they do is then they beat themselves up or make them, and they just, it's a cycle where they feel worse and worse about themselves.
Absolutely.
So having compassion, I think, is, you know, and to just say, okay, I'm feeling small right now, and to be okay with that, and to kind of, you know, hug yourself. That sounds ridiculous, I know, but it's true, really, that idea of, like, just, it shouldn't sound ridiculous that we would, like, be kind to ourselves or hug ourselves, but but that's the thing. It kind of does.
Well, but, you know, it kind of doesn't. Well, I may have a bias, but but it kind of doesn't sound ridiculous, and it is so critical, and so many times, I can't even think about the number of times I have talked to folks and reminded them that the way they're treating themselves completely without compassion is in no way, shape, or form the way they would treat a friend.
Yes.
And if you could really think about being a friend to yourself, I mean, just that shift is for some folks, for many folks, really hard, but it's so amazing. It's so amazing.
It is. It really, really is. I mean, that's why that was the genesis, really, for this book. Was once I had come through the other side, and I remembered a moment when I was sitting on my front step being terrified, and I imagined, like, were there other people sitting on their front steps feeling terrified? And I thought, well, what would I do if I drove by somebody who was feeling that way? And I knew what I would do. I would, you know, pull over and walk up to them, and I'd sit down next to them, put my arm around them, and say, you know, you're going to be okay. You know, I wanted to reach my hand out. I wanted to say what I said earlier, which is, you're stronger than you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, nobody's talking about this.
Right.
I'm going to talk about this.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And yet, the other thing that you've said, which is really interesting, is that you weren't taking any medication, because certainly going to any licensed medical or mental health professional, the minute that you are diagnosed as having an anxiety, anything, the second sentence is really about medication. And that's, you know, in a lot of ways, that's really not okay. Although certainly as a clinician myself, I understand it. But if you have the sense that medication is not something that's going to work for you with something like anxiety, and you're willing to put in the time and the work and to feel those feelings, then sometimes not taking medication really should be okay. A lot of times it's driven really by the insurance companies.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing, because it's just so, people are so certain about it. Like, this is just, it's so automatic now. Oh, this
yes.
is what you have. This is the medication you get.
Right.
And people were dismayed that I was refusing it. But you know, I wouldn't trade that, as you know, as terrifying and demoralizing as the experience was, I wouldn't trade it for anything, because coming through panic, you know, on my own 2 feet and figuring, you know, finding my way through actually made me, you know, less fearful than I'd ever been in my entire life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not that I don't still, you know, like if I'm driving on a highway, that's my residual. It didn't leave me untouched, you know, okay. I'm unscathed. I still don't like to drive on the highway. So, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm all perfect and now, you know, but the experience taught me so much about myself and kind of how to be happy.
Which is the most important piece. Let me just say about medication. For some people, medication really is a good and useful tool. And for some folks, not so much. And I think that's the thing. If you're paying attention to being the compassionate you, you really begin to think about what's true for you and
yes,
not judge yourself up against other people.
Yeah, and medication is sometimes, I mean, a saving grace for so many people. And mm-hmm. it's not, you know, and that's, by all means, I think that's my whole point, is whatever you need, whatever a person needs to feel better, and if somebody needs medication, and a lot of people do, that there's nothing wrong with it at all. It's just I'm stubborn. But so that wasn't my path, but I think there are so many different ways through, and I think it's more to reject that there's, like you were saying earlier, that there's only one way.
Right.
I think what's empowering is to find our own way.
What is your life like today?
I have my horse Claret, and he's mischievous and adorable, and I ride him several times a week, and I write, and I have 3 dogs and a lot of love, and live gratefully, and working on a novel right now, so that's very exciting. When I was running away, all those years ago, if somebody would have shown me a snapshot of, well, this is what you're running toward, I would have been happy.
Well, the other, I think, important lesson from your story is that even in the worst of times, if you continue to sort of push yourself through in whatever way that you need to do that, there really is another side.
There is. There always is. You know, well, and we can tell ourselves all kinds of lies about that
right.
You know, it's never going to get better, but it's not true.
It isn't true, and that's the piece, I think, that's one of the pieces that is so critical about your story, and certainly for folks who are struggling with anxiety in the moment that you are dealing with your particular anxiety experience, it's really hard to recognize that, A, this is not going to happen forever, B, that there is another side, and that C, I can actually get there. And what your book shows repeatedly is that there is another side and you can get there. And yes, you can get knocked down a whole bunch of times, but you can also get up a whole bunch of times as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Rita, how would folks get in touch? Is there a website or something that you would recommend to folks?
How they would get in touch with me?
If there is a way to do that.
Yeah. So my website is ritazoechin.com, and there, my email is on there, ritazoechin@gmail.com. So I'm pretty easy.
All right. Can you spell your name for me?
Absolutely. It's RitaZoeChin.
All right, so RitaZoeChin.com and RitaZoeChin@gmail.com.
Yes.
Okay. In your relationship with your husband, as you were going through your experiences, he was too. And certainly as a physician, I would imagine that he went through all sort of mental gyrations. What's your sense of what your experience was like for him?
I was actually the emotional, you know, I was very solid and very strong in the relationship emotionally. And, you know, we had just gone through a big move, and I was kind of, you know, ushering him forward, taking care of him. I was like his touchstone. And so when I started being afraid of showering by myself, that was really hard for him because, you know, number one, like we were talking about earlier, as a physician, he wanted to fix it quickly. And that's not how it was going to work for me. But, you know, two, he was losing, you know, he felt he was losing his support. And I think that that was scary for him because, you know, it's like, well, what's happening? You know, his life is unraveling before his eyes, and how far will I go? And will I ever get up off the couch again? So, I think it was terrifying to him in another way.
Sure.
But he was a good sport about it, and you know, pretty steadfast.
So he's a keeper.
Yes.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Again, Let the Tornado Come, a memoir by Rita Zoe Chin. That is RitaZoeChin.com and RitaZoeChin@gmail.com. Thank you so much, Rita, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I am delighted. And folks, remember that Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. For more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org to listen to this program and any other program. Again, you can also go to mindtalk.org. All the programs are there and available to you on demand. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Courtney Ebu is the social media coordinator. Thank you all very much for your assistance. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, and that's what it is, unacceptable, you take care.